chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a lot to cover this week. We've got impeachment. We've got election there problems. People are trying to limit our speech, and that is a big biggie for everyone. Censorship is right at center of this program today, and we've had a lot of people speaking out. Even some of your civil rights groups and civil liberties groups are beginning to speak out, okay, against these limitations that are being imposed. So first, we're going to start off an Epoch News, Epoch Times report on China interfering with our election. Here we go with that now.
Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe assessed that China interfered in the 2020 U.S. federal elections, according to a letter transmitted to Congress. In the letter, Ratcliffe alleges that intelligence about China's election interference was suppressed by management at the CIA, which pressured analysts to withdraw their support for the view. Citing a report by the Intelligence Community Analytic Ombudsman Barry Zulauf, the Director of National Intelligence said some analysts were reluctant to describe China's actions as election interference because they disagreed with the policies of President Donald Trump. The Washington Examiner published Ratcliffe's letter and the Ombudsman report on January 17, 10 days after publishing an original report on the documents. The ODNI did not respond to requests from the Epoch Times to authenticate the documents. Ratcliffe wrote, based on all available sources of intelligence, with definitions consistently applied and reached independent of political considerations or undue pressure, that the People's Republic of China sought to influence the 2020 U.S. federal elections. The report by Zulauf, the Intelligence Community Analytic Ombudsman, was sent to Congress on January the 7th alongside an Intelligence Community Assessment of Interference in the 2020 election. In the report, Zulauf states the analysts working on Russia and China applied different standards to their reporting on election interference. While labeling Russia's activity as clear election interference, the analysts were reluctant to do the same for China. Zulauf wrote, given analytic differences in the way Russia and China analysts examined their targets, China analysts appeared hesitant to assess Chinese actions as undue influence or interference. These analysts appeared reluctant to have their analysis on China brought forward because they tended to disagree with the administration's policies, saying in effect, I don't want our intelligence used to support those policies. Neither the Ombudsman report nor the letter from Ratcliffe includes details on China's meddling. Zulauf redirected an interview request to the ODNI, which did not respond to an emailed request. The Analytic Ombudsman's report assesses that politicization occurred in relation to both Russia's and China's election interference. Zulauf assessed that neither intelligence community leaders nor analysts are at fault, blaming the hyperpartisan atmosphere in the United States instead. In most cases, what we see is the entire system responding to and resisting pressures from outside, rather than attempts to politicize intelligence by our leaders or analysts. The report states that the analysts who assessed Russia's election interference had complained that the intelligence community management was reluctant to deliver their assessments to government clients because the work was not well received. Analysts saw this as suppression of intelligence, bordering on politicization of intelligence from above, Zulauf wrote. The Epoch Times had previously documented a multi-pronged election influence campaign linked to the Chinese Communist Party. In a December 3rd op-ed, Ratcliffe said the CCP poses the greatest threat to America today and the greatest threat to democracy and freedom worldwide since World War II. He wrote, the intelligence is clear. Beijing intends to dominate the US and the rest of the planet economically, militarily, and technologically. Many of China's major public initiatives and prominent companies offer only a layer of camouflage to the activities of the Chinese Communist Party. Congress certified Joe Biden as the president-elect on January the 7th. In the 2 months leading up to the certification, Trump challenged the outcome of the election in 7 states, citing unconstitutional changes to election laws and potentially illegally cast votes.
There you go, Epoch Times reporting. And so this is after the election. But we had information and evidence that there were foreign entities interfering with the 2020 election. That's for sure. And this is what John Brennan has had to say since January 6th intrusion into the U.S. Capitol. And he's saying we ought to go after all of these extremist Christian groups and even libertarians and people like that. And this is a very ominous statement that John Brennan, former CIA director, and also he was CIA director, okay, under Barack Obama, and got caught spying on senators and senator staff members in the U.S. Congress. So it's so are we going to believe John Brennan when he says something? But this is very threatening what he says. Also, those 2 reports on China interfering, they'll be on our site. One is a letter by the ombudsman, and then the other one is a 14-page report. But you can find that at thesecrettruth.com. But right now, John Brennan is saying there are dangerous groups out there, and we have to go after them. John Brennan is a very dangerous person himself. Here we go now.
I was thinking today that this is the most relaxed I've been in the course of many inaugurations I've watched, because I'm not responsible for it. But I can tell you that when I was in the government, I had white knuckles because of the nature of the threats. But it's so much more difficult today because of what we have seen, not just over the last 2 weeks, but that certainly has riveted our attention, but because of this growth in polarization in the United States and domestic violence in white supremacist groups. So I know looking forward that the members of the Biden team who have been nominated or have been appointed are now moving in laser-like fashion to try to uncover as much as they can about what looks very similar to insurgency movements that we've seen overseas, mm-hmm. where they germinate in different parts of the country and they gain strength, and it brings together an unholy alliance frequently of religious extremists, authoritarians, fascists, bigots, racists, nativists, even libertarians. And unfortunately, I think there has been this momentum that has been generated as a result of, unfortunately, the demagogic rhetoric of people that's just departed government, but also those who continue in the halls of Congress. And so I really do think that the law enforcement, Homeland Security, intelligence, and even the defense officials are doing everything possible to root out what seems to be a very, very serious and insidious threat to our democracy and our republic.
I want to read you a little bit of how.
There you go, John Brennan stating that, well, it's real dangerous out there now, and so we've got to get after this. And it was a setup. January the 6th was a setup. And some radical elements went in there and agent provocateured the attack or the intrusion into the U.S. Capitol and made the Trump supporters and allied people very, very bad. But anyway, Tulsi Gabbard, Kilmeade, that's hosting a new program in the evening on Fox, interviewed Tulsi Gabbard recently, and here's what she had to say about the danger of our right to free speech and so forth. But here we go with this interview by Kilmeade of Tulsi Gabbard. Tulsi is a U.S. representative from Hawaii. Here we go now.
Former Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii, Democrat, joins us now. Congresswoman, great to see you. I know you've been out of the job for a week or two. Are you surprised they're pushing forward with this extra surveillance on would-be domestic terror?
It's so dangerous. You know, as you guys have been talking about, this is an issue that all Democrats, Republicans, Independents, Libertarians should be extremely concerned about, especially because we don't have to guess about where this goes or how this ends. When you have people like former CIA Director John Brennan openly talking about how he's spoken with or heard from appointees and nominees in the Biden administration who are already starting to look across our country for these types of movements similar to the insurgencies they've seen overseas that, in his words, he says, make up this unholy alliance of religious extremists, racists, bigots. He lists a few others and adds at the end, even libertarians. So when you look at their process and they start looking at, okay, what characteristics right. are we looking for as we're building this profile of a potential extremist? What are we talking about? Religious extremists? Are we talking about Christians, evangelical Christians? What is a religious extremist? Is it somebody who's pro-life? I mean, where do you take this? You start looking at, okay, well, obviously you have to be a white person, obviously. Likely male, libertarians, well, if anybody who loves freedom, liberty, maybe has an American flag outside their house, or people who, you know, attended a Trump rally. Once you start walking this down the path, you see where it leads to a very dangerous undermining of our civil liberties, mm-hmm. our freedoms in our Constitution, and a targeting of almost half of the country.
Ewan Omar says this. We already have laws on the books, sorry, but you are just going to have to learn to apply them. The other thing I thought was interesting, Congresswoman, I don't see any FBI demanding more tools. They feel they got the tools. These are congressional leaders or members who feel as though they're so freaked out by Trump supporters, they still can't understand why anyone would support him. They want to get to the bottom of it. And do you think the whole deprogramming of Trump supporters, this new buzzword among detractors and Democrats, has anything to do with this?
Yeah, I think it does very directly. I think just on the FBI front, I read a great op-ed this morning from a former FBI agent who made a very strong case for why this new domestic terror law introduced by Adam Schiff is wrong and is directly going to undermine our constitutional rights and freedoms. This whole effort, whether you're talking about this bill or people saying that we have to deprogram these Trump cultists and people who voted for Trump because they've been radicalized, all of this just goes to further mm-hmm. tear our country apart. And it moves towards the thing Joe Biden said in his inauguration speech that he shouldn't happen, which is a dehumanization right. of your opponent. And that's where his voice is so necessary right now. He is right. the president of this country. He delivered this speech, his voice, himself, speaking to the American people. He needs to denounce people like John Brennan and their statements, bills like the one Adam Schiff put forward, and truly speak to the American people about how we must come right. together around, you know, the Constitution, around our Bill of Rights, around these rights that have been endowed to us by our Creator.
If he had your leadership ability, he would do it. Maybe he still will. That's why she ran for president. Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian.
You know, people, just very sensical people like Tulsi Gabbard, I consider her to be a very sensible person, have some very strong views. And it's about protecting our liberties and our freedoms and our rights. And these attacks that are ongoing right now are very dangerous to our liberties and freedoms and so forth. But coming up next is a Tucker Carlson interviewed Miranda Devine. Now, Miranda Devine broke the story about Hunter Biden's laptop or notebook computer that was left at that repairman shop. And the big tech media, everyone, they buried the story, put a lid on it, and you never heard it before the election. So this is what our great, you know, big tech people are doing. They are already censoring and limiting free speech and so forth already. And this is what dangerous. So here we go with Tucker and Miranda Devine, who is really a stand-up lady. So here we go next.
So the censorship campaign that we're living under now and that appears to be accelerating, they just took an entire social media platform off the internet and disappeared it. But it began to begin in earnest in October, right before the election, when big tech united as one to censor a very specific story. It ran the New York Post, the country's oldest newspaper. And that story, as you'll remember, was about the Biden family's influence peddling operation. Now, the big tech company told us that was disinformation. It wasn't. It was all true. In fact, there is still an active federal investigation into Joe Biden's family, excuse me, his son, about his overseas business dealings. Just before the election, we spoke to a man called Tony Bobulinski, who was in fact a business partner of the Bidens and knew the details. Here's part of what he told us.
And so then Hunter and his father and security came through the bar, and obviously I stood up out of respect to shake his hand, and Hunter introduced me as, this is Tony, Dad, the individual I told you about that's helping us with the business that we're working on and the Chinese.
So it was clear to you that Joe Biden's son had told him about this business?
Crystal clear.
Now, the White House, aligned with Silicon Valley, has to make a decision. Will the media, will they allow the media effectively to cover the story anymore? It's hard to imagine we've been asking that question in this country, but we have to because it's a real question. Miranda Devine is a columnist for the New York Post. She's been on this story since the first day it came out and reporting on it for us. Miranda, thanks so much for coming on. So this raises a really interesting and obvious question I have not heard asked before, which is, what do you do about a story about the president and his family now that the president is actually the president?
Hi, Tucker. Well, I don't really hold out much hope that a very incurious media is going to change their tune. You could say that Joe Biden won the election because of the censorship and the favorable reporting that he received. And now you saw just from the first press conference just a little over an hour ago that the media is really eating out of the Biden administration's hands. Only one reporter, that was Peter Doocy from Fox News, asked a question that was difficult, and that was one about unity. How can you possibly be preaching unity when you're trying to impeach the your predecessor? So I don't think that anything will change. And all we saw before the election was that the media was quite happy to accept some complete nonsense from people like John Brennan and his former colleagues, the spooks, so-called, who told us that the Hunter Biden laptop was Russian disinformation. Well, it wasn't. But now they have a new bogeyman. And as you rightly said, Joe Biden put it out there in his supposedly unifying inauguration speech today. It's domestic terrorists. It's white supremacists. And the definition of that depends on whether you're with us or you're against us.
That's exactly right. I can't imagine a less unifying way to organize your administration. Miranda Devine, I know that you will continue to be on the story. I appreciate your coming on. Thank you.
Thanks, Tucker.
That was Devine, Miranda Devine. Coming up is an interview that Tucker had with Glenn Greenwald, and he was formerly with The Intercept, and he had a falling out with them just recently, and I believe he's affiliated with Substack, which is a conglomeration of a group of community of independent writers called Substack.com. So anyway, this is a good interview, and Glenn Greenwald is also upset about censorship and so forth. Here we go now with that interview.
Glenn Greenwald is the most independent of independent journalists. He writes on Substack, where we hope you support him. He joins us tonight. Glenn, this is starting to make me a little bit nervous. Do the rest of us have cause to be concerned about this trend?
Absolutely. A lot of times if you warn of a danger, you have to piece things together in order to demonstrate that it's actually coming. In this case, you don't have to. They're explicitly saying precisely what they want to do. The thing that struck me so much about that John Brennan video is, it would be one thing if they were saying, look, there's a band of people, 20 here, 50 over here, who wear swastika armbands, who still are in the KKK, there's maybe 2,000, we need to... That's not what they're saying. What he's saying is the exact opposite. Every group he lifted, even libertarians, it's essentially, he's defining the insurgency as anyone who has an ideology other than neoliberalism. In other words, other than the ruling class view that is about to congeal and merge with the power of the state. And what they're talking about explicitly, Tucker, is using the tools that they used to take ISIS off the internet, the tools that they used to destroy Al-Qaeda. They're talking about it as a second war on terror. And that first war on terror, no matter what your views were originally at the beginning of 9/11, ended up eroding not civil liberties, just elsewhere, but here at home as well. One that is born by name of being a domestic war on terror designed to essentially criminalize any oppositional ideology to the ruling class. There is literally nothing that could be more dangerous, and it's not fear-mongering or alarmism to say it. There are bills pending by Adam Schiff as well that would simply take the existing war on terror legislation always aimed at foreign governments and foreign actors and simply amend it to say we can now do that within the United States.
Who's going to stand up in opposition to this? I don't see any of the corporate Republican caucus really even noticing. I see a lot of people I thought were liberal turn out to be not liberal at all, but more authoritarian. So how do we prevent this from happening? Any idea?
Well, one of the things I'm really hoping for is that we can finally get out of enough people believing that the way to understand Washington is Democrat versus Republican, and that you side with one team and believe they're on your side and defending yes. your interest, and the other team is your enemy. It is not true. There is a ruling class elite that is extremely comfortable with the establishment wings of both parties. They love Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer every bit as much as they love Mitch McConnell and Mitt Romney and Marco Rubio and Paul Ryan. Those are the people who they fund equally because those are the people who serve their agenda. Then there's a whole other huge group of people at whose expense they rule, and some of them consider themselves on the left and some consider themselves on the right, and it's time to break down those barriers. I was super enthused to see a group of 8 left-wing politicians, including Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and others, say, we will not allow a new war on terror because we know how dangerous it can be. Let them stand with right-wing members to break down this artificial, false, fraudulent prism that the way to understand Washington is thinking that one of the two parties is on your side. Neither of them is.
I have a feeling a lot of people are going to be saving that permanently, what you just said, on their DVRs. And I certainly hope they do, because you're right. Glenn Greenwald, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tucker.
Coming up next is we had some recent release of emails and so forth. And this is an interview of John Solomon by Lou Dobbs about the Christopher Steele document and so forth. And this is really insightful. Here we go next, right now.
Breaking tonight, newly declassified and released documents show that Christopher Steele confessed to the FBI that he leaked the false Russian collusion narrative in order to try to help Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign against Donald Trump. The document states, quote, Steele and Burroughs, who was Steele's partner, described President Trump as their main opponent and indicated they were fearful that Trump's presidency might negatively affect the historic U.S. alliance with the U.K. and their special relationship. Well, among the documents secured by Just the News, Editor-in-Chief John Solomon now, Christopher Steele's admission that he chose his allegiance to Hillary Clinton over his work with the FBI. The FBI notes further revealing, quote, Steele explained that as the election season went on, they, as a company, were riding two horses, their client, Hillary Clinton, and the FBI. And after FBI Director James Comey's reopening of the Hillary Clinton investigation as the election approached, they had to pick one horse and choose the business-client relationship over the relationship with the FBI. They followed what their client wanted, and they spoke to the press. Solomon is now reporting the FBI opened an investigation in 2014 into a foreign power's efforts to influence Hillary Clinton. 2014. But that investigation was, well, it was stonewalled by FBI leadership. It's seventh floor. An FBI employee wrote to then-director James Comey in April of 2015, quote, The FISA application has remained in limbo for the last 4 months, even though subsequent investigative activity by Redacted provided additional probable cause for the FISA application. So instead of a FISA warrant, the FBI gave Clinton a defensive briefing. Entirely different the way in which they handled false Russia collusion claims against presidential candidate Donald Trump. Why? Well, we know the answer. Hillary Clinton was their preferred candidate. John Solomon, editor-in-chief of Just the News, best-selling author, and he has breaking news on the FBI's efforts to investigate a foreign money plot against Hillary Clinton. John, good to see you. What can you tell us?
Well, listen, one of the most interesting things is looking at the contemporaneous documents. There were people inside the FBI, lead agents in the field, who were developing this evidence that a foreign power wanted to give large sums of money to Hillary Clinton to help her campaign in an effort to curry favor. And they became enormously frustrated. 4 months passed after they filled out their FISA application, and nobody was getting back to them. One of the agents became so bold as to write directly to Director James Comey and ask, you know, what's going on here? My guys are upset, and we want to get this tool. In fact, we found more evidence since we filed the FISA. What are you doing? And James Comey claimed ignorance. I don't know what's going on here, he said, but I'll try to get smart about it. What we learned is that from all the documents we've seen, they didn't do the FISA, and instead they went to Hillary Clinton instead, gave her a defensive briefing saying, hey, could be a foreign power, be careful where you take your money, the sort of thing they didn't do for Donald Trump. Donald Trump never got a defensive briefing on Russia. He did get a FISA, and that we now know was based on false information.
Yeah, we wouldn't, I don't know that we should say he got a FISA. He was FISA'd. Whereas Hillary Clinton wasn't.
That's right.
The foreign power. Which foreign power?
We don't know. And sadly, the documents leave out the name of the foreign power.
I'm willing to speculate.
Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to think of that country which seemed to have benefited most while she was Secretary of State. I'm thinking of that country that somehow managed to gain control of 20% of our uranium reserves. That's the one
I've been
waved
off of. I know Russia would be a natural one to think about. Ukraine's another one you might think about. She had a lot of financial donors there. China's another one you'd think about. I'm told China and Russia are not the country, but the other countries will not. They won't confirm or the country. And I'm still reporting on that. We'll try to get to the bottom of that over the next few days.
I would like to know why there was no investigation. By that I mean a real and constructive investigation by the FBI into Uranium One. That still remains a huge mystery. The declassification of the document, Steele's overt statement that he was working for Hillary Clinton, the FBI knew that. They knew that in 2017. And they knew that and created a special counsel. Well, I think so, too, because they were a part of the first attempts to frame General Michael Flynn. So they were on a mission already. Your point is exact. My question here is, the FBI knew it, the Justice Department knew it, the intelligence chiefs knew it, and they combined and acted in concert to destroy first the candidacy of Donald J. Trump and then his presidency. And we have witnessed this. We have known this. These documents further corroborate it. And there isn't a single soul among those corrupt officials who've been held accountable. And not anyone in the left-wing national media, as far as I know, has put those facts before their readers, their listeners, and their viewers and users. And said, this is the truth, and what we carried to you in giant buckets from 2016 and 2017 on was a lie. Why not?
Yeah, there's a conspiracy of silence, and I think the news media is ashamed of its reporting, so they've just moved on and pretend it didn't happen. And I think that's unfortunate. We learning some new things in these documents, even as we speak. The FBI was aware that Hillary Clinton's inner circle was working on a Russia collusion narrative as early as April 2016, way earlier than we thought. We've always been told July was sort of the ignition date. Right. We now learn in these documents, April, Cody Scherer, one of the inner members of the Clinton advisory team, was putting together a lot of the salacious stuff that later became part of Steele's dossier. In April, he gives it to a State Department official. State Department official gives it to Steele. And then there's an effort to try to acquire or buy a tape from Russia. Christopher Steele even thought that was going to be a trap. He thought that was a setup and there. Yeah. But the extent to which the Clinton team was trying to create a false narrative about Donald Trump, it showed very few bounds.
John Solomon, thank you for all of your work throughout the past 4 years. As we have all in this country witnessed a president subverted, his agenda blocked and opposed at every turn by the deep state, the Democrat Party, and with absolute abandon for integrity, for honesty, it's a shame what we have permitted to happen to a great president, but it would be as tragic for even a middling president. It's a shame that this Republican Party didn't have the guts, the will, the principle to stand up. Shame on the leadership of the Republican Party. Shame on all of those who could have made a difference who chose to avert their eyes. John Solomon, luckily the nation had you. We appreciate it. And thank you, Senator.
The corruption up in Washington, D.C. is astoundingly high. And that's what our American public, the good American public from the left and the right, and everybody in between, all kinds of religions and all kinds of different ethnic, so-called ethnic groups, are beginning to wake up that our government has been very corrupt, and the money has corrupted everyone on the Democratic, many people on the Democratic and many people on the Republican side. And they want to maintain this dialectic of left and right, Democrat and Republic. That's why they don't want a third party. And that's really why they fear Trump and their talk about this Patriot Party. But I'll make some comments here at the very end about that. What we're going to bring up is Laura Ingraham's interview of Jonathan Turley. He's a law professor, and he talks about this upcoming impeachment. And many people have said because the president is out of office that the primary reason for impeachment is removal of office and then other, charges. But he says that they're trying to bring this thing up to keep him from entering into the 2024 race as a viable candidate. So here we go with Laura Ingraham and Jonathan Turley with a very insightful interview. And I'll make a few comments at the end of this.
Joining me now is Jonathan Turley, George Washington University law professor and constitutional law expert and Fox News contributor. Jonathan, is there any way that John Roberts could decide that he will not preside over this impeachment? Could he just refuse?
Well, he can. You know, he's not a bus. He doesn't pick up everyone that he stops next to. You know, he has to determine whether this is a function that is given to him by the Constitution. The problem is that the Constitution states that the Chief Justice shall preside over a trial of the president. The president in this trial will be Joe Biden, and I doubt the Democrats want to remove him. And so there's a threshold issue for Roberts. He might not even be asked, but that will beg the question of who is being tried. It's clearly not the president, and it's clearly not to remove him from office. It is a private citizen who the Senate will vote on removing from an office that he's already left. Now, that creates a serious threshold issue for the Senate. In fact, they may have the most consequential vote ahead of them in their entire tenure as senators, and that is whether to go forward with this trial. The Constitution states that the principal question for impeachment is whether to remove the president. And that creates a rather curious vote. And the problem is that constitutional novelties can easily become constitutional nuisances. We've already had a snap impeachment where the House didn't even hold a single hearing to consider the language or implications of the impeachment, give a formal opportunity for the president to respond. And now we're going to hand a snap impeachment over to a retroactive trial. That is a very serious question for all these senators to weigh. And I'll point out one other thing. There were only two cases in history where this type of retroactive measure was used. And the first one was with William Blunt. And when that happened, many of the signers of the Constitution were in Congress. Most of them were still alive. Blunt himself was a signer. And he was a former, he was a senator who had been expelled from the Senate. The Senate refused to hold the trial. So when the ink had just barely dried on the Constitution, the Senate had a threshold vote and said, we're not going to do this.
Yeah, you could pretty much understand the intent of the framers when a lot of the framers were right there. You didn't have to do it, go much into the legislative history, even if you believe that, because they were there. That's a fascinating point, Jonathan. Also, I want to point out to something that a lot of legal scholars have said in response to your argument just now about the removal. You can't remove him from office because he's already gone from office. So a group of these scholars penned an open letter. Don't you love the open letters? That argues that the disqualification from holding future office is equal to the removal from the office in the Constitution. Now, I don't understand how that could be possibly read into the Constitution, but these are some, you know, very well-respected constitutional scholars who are arguing with this. Why are they wrong?
Well, I know, and like many of them, I actually responded to that letter on my blog today because I believe it's ultimately wrong. But I have to stress, these are good faith arguments. This has been an open debate. I've wrestled with this since 1999. I talked about the value of even retroactive trials. But what I believe today is that those values are outweighed by the costs, and I don't agree with what the letter says. Disqualification is an optional penalty that the Senate may impose, but it is only considered after the main task of impeachment is done. You've tried and removed a president. And when they talk about future disqualification, it's in a sentence that is meant to limit the power of the Senate, to say you can't go beyond removal or disqualification.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that these things are equal in that sense.
And by the way, Richard Blumenthal says that we can do this trial in just a matter of days, Jonathan. But isn't that also up to the president's defense team? I mean, what if they want to put on a multi-day or even a few weeks defense? Are we going to have the presiding judge say, no, you can only do X number of days? So they want to have a snap impeachment happen really fast, and they hope take him out at the knees.
Right. This is all improvisational, and that's dangerous when it has to be also constitutional. And, you know, I did the last judicial impeachment trial with colleagues that was held in the Senate, it took us months to present that case. They're about to try a president in a blink without a hearing in the House, in a snap impeachment, and now a retroactive trial.
No. Jonathan Turley, thank you so much for being here tonight.
In addition to this having many constitutional objections and issues, and probably rightfully so, there's a bill of attainder that could be objected to, even if they went through with the trial and convicted him. Kenneth Starr brought that up recently in an interview, and he's saying that this is acting in such a way that resembles a bill of attainder, and that's when a legislative body acts against individuals, and that's not allowed by our Constitution, to prohibit them, to restrict them and convict them or whatever. Now, you can remove a sitting president, but when you start convicting people outside after they've left that office, then you're getting into some really real problems here. Coming up next is an interview that John Solomon has with Jessica Anderson, and she's head of executive action. And they're talking about these election problems and how to go about solving some of these election problems. So here we go with that now.
All right, I want to get to election integrity because, you know, there's an us and them thing where people say there's no fraud, and then the conservatives say, well, there was all these irregularities, and the truth is that there were enormous irregularities. There were entire rule changes made to the election that legislatures never sanctioned, and therefore I think increasingly will be ruled unconstitutional, sadly, well after the election. Wisconsin Supreme Court has already delivered one landmark decision that exempting 200,000 people in Wisconsin from the voter ID requirements for absentee ballots was unconstitutional. A pandemic didn't give everybody the right to say, I'm homebound and do it. They're going to be more like that. But, you know, there have been two approaches. There are some that are cursing the darkness, right? We lost. It's unfair. You guys are leaning into the future. You're trying to change the future. The past is the past. You're trying to lead to the future. Tell us what you're doing on the election integrity front and how it can impact 2022-2024.
Well, first off, I think we all just need to take a pause and collectively recognize that we as Americans, as voters, we deserve to have an electoral system that we can have faith in, that we can trust the integrity of the election, the legitimacy of the results. And that's exactly what was so broken and shattered in the 2020 election. And it's going to require a comprehensive strategy to correct it. It's not going to be this quick thing that's just fixed overnight. And I really think that there's kind of two severe consequences that we're dealing with that we have to handle separately, and then eventually they come together. The first is recognizing that when there is fraud, it jeopardizes that the election is free and fair. And not only is the vote delegitimized, but then we as voters, we're discouraged from participating in the electoral process. And so you've got two problems that need fixing. So I think one, in the short term, we've got this H.R. 1. This is Nancy Pelosi's progressive plan to federalize the entire election system. And this is really the worst of the worst when you look at elections. This is her saying, okay, Georgia, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, you made these additional allowances of convenience. It's called voter convenience. You made these additional allowances of voter convenience because of COVID. Not only are we going to make it permanent, but I'm going to add a bunch of other stuff in here to federalize the election process. So I'm going to do things like, instead of having a photo ID card to vote, you just need to have proof of identity. So that means you could have something as simple as like a cable bill, right?
Right.
And then you vote. So big problem with that. You look at some of the other pieces of H.R. 1 where it forces states to restore felon voting rights. It automatically registers 16 and 17-year-olds to cast ballots in federal elections before they even turn 18. It creates all of these different actions that just expand the federal footprint over election law because it federalizes the system instead of having it in this state-by-state process. Now, yes, every state is different. Therefore, it's more complex and there's legal stuff. But that's the beauty of federalism. And H.R. 1 just absolves that. So the word on the street is now the House is in session, is in recess next week. They'll be in session the week after. The rumor is that H.R. 1 is going to come to a floor. I think conservatives need to be acutely focused on working to ensure that H.R. 1 does not get a vote on the House floor. And I think to do that, we need to be talking to, as grassroots Americans right now, we need to be talking to some of these vulnerable Democrats that are in red districts. Everyone from like a Ron Kind in Wisconsin to a Katie Porter in California to Sean Patrick Mahoney in New York. Sandberger, Virginia.
Yeah, I mentioned Sandberger, right?
Yeah, Colin Algert in Texas. I mean, there's a long list. There's about 20 Democrats that are in red districts. They need to hear from us that this is not okay, that federalizing the election system is not okay. If we can hold back Pelosi's desire to advance H.R. 1, then it will allow us to have this second prong approach, which is to fix some of these state laws. And so when we look at the list of states that were the most vulnerable around their election laws, and I'm talking about Georgia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, even some parts of Florida, certainly Nevada, Michigan, Arizona. Every single one of these states has a different set of problems that need fixing. And some of that fixing is going to come from ballot initiatives. Some of it's going to need to come from direct state-based lobbying. But as the first step is having a grading rubric where we can look comprehensively, is your state ready for the next election? Here are the 15 criteria to tell you yes or no, and then here's where to fix it. A ballot initiative, a state lobbying effort, something that the governor can do. And then we can literally systematically go state by state to make some of these corrections. I think that this is going to take a year or two. I don't think this is going to be done, you know, quarter one of this year. Some state legislators recognize their problems, like a state like Iowa. They're already trying to fix and clean up their books. North Carolina, the state legislators there, they are so laser focused on this.
Yeah, they are.
They're going to fix some problems sooner than later. Georgia was a national disgrace. They're going to look closely at this. So we need to make sure, I think, as grassroots Americans, to put the pressure on these state legislators to make the changes where they can, where they need to, because if not, this erosion of public trust in the election system is just going to get worse. And we're not going to find our way out of it. And not only that, but we're going to have elections that are selected by fraudsters and not chosen by the people. So we've got to have this kind of 1-2 punch where we block HR 1 from federalizing the election systems here in Washington. And then we start tackling some of these state laws and that we're transparent, that we tell the American people the changes that we are making as we make them. So that way we build back that trust so that you voter in Georgia, you voter in North Carolina and Wisconsin and in Pennsylvania, wherever, that you can actually trust that your vote is safe and secure and it wasn't just rigged and stolen at the end of the night. So, you know, we've got a lot of work to do. I think this is the best way to do it. Block HR 1 and then start tackling some of these state laws and to do it in a real systematic way where we start with a report card. Everyone lay everything on the table. What are the changes? And then who, what body of the legislature makes that change that's needed for your state?
So important. And you mentioned the legislators. That meant most of the states you mentioned are under Republican control when it comes to legislators. And I've talked to many state legislators who said, man, we were asleep at the switch. We didn't realize that what the Wisconsin Election Commissioner, Governor Evers, was doing in Wisconsin or what the consent decree in Georgia occurred. We didn't realize they were changing our intent. Are you engaged at the state legislative level? And are these legislators, particularly Republicans who control both houses in most of those states, are they ready to reclaim their right in under the Constitution to set the rules themselves?
Very much so. I think you've got not only state legislators that realize that they've been asleep at the wheel, that they need to do more, that they need to take an audit of the books and really understand the election law, but then also like the technology that's around the election, the procedures that are set at the precinct level, the waiting period for ballots. I mean, it is a long list of things and a long list of responsibilities that state legislators have. And so they're waking up to this. They need support from grassroots Americans to take this serious. And I think we need to go in as a group like Heritage Action. And of course, there are others that are doing this so well that can go in and talk them through the legal stuff and where to make the changes and to get this done, because we cannot have another election in 2022 where we've fundamentally lost trust and that we can't trust the legitimacy or the outcome. We cannot go through this again as a nation. So yeah. I think it has to be the top priority. I really do. And I think, you know, we're going to have policy fights here on the legislative side. We're going to have nominations moving through from Biden's cabinet and his agenda. Obviously, Pelosi and Schumer will have a legislative agenda. We're going to be stretched as a country of activists to, on one hand, follow that and try to stop it where we can. And on the other hand, really look specifically with these state legislators, with these governors, to make the changes that are needed to make our election laws safe and secure.
One last question on elections, and I know you got to go. We're going to continue this conversation next week, because next week Heritage Action and Just the News are going to have a very special one-hour event where we're going to talk a lot more about the agenda and what conservatives can do to change the future. But I want to ask you about this. This is the first election, certainly that I'm aware of, where a major donor donated hundreds of millions of dollars, not to a candidate, not to a political action committee, not to a party, not even to a 527 group. They donated it directly to the election judges, the election rulers, the election workers. And we're talking about Mark Zuckerberg and his group that put $350 million to try to influence the judges and the conductors of elections by giving them lots of money and then setting rules. Do you think there's an appetite in America to cut off that form of injection of money into our election system? It's not going to candidates. It's not even publicly disclosed unless you have FOIA. Is that an area that isn't part of your election integrity agenda?
I think it has to be. And I think the reality is when you look at a situation like the Zuckerberg donation, this is the law evolving. These are not issues that America had 20 years ago.
Yeah, great
and
point.
So we have to be willing, not only at the federal level through Congress, but through the courts to go in to answer the hard questions around this. Is that okay? You know, Facebook tries to have it all the different ways, right? They're nonpartisan, they're a public utility, they're a private company. Like they say all those different things and you, at a certain point that just can't stand. And I think you have to have courageous leaders like what we see with Senator Hawley and Senator Cruz that are asking these hard questions about tech, big tech's role in our day-to-day life. And that's where the law has to evolve. And we have to be able to meet the country's changes with a legal response. And so I think Congress needs to look at this through not only their hearings and their jurisdiction, but I think it probably needs to look, be looked at through the courts as well, and to understand if this is okay. And if it is okay, then what are the guardrails for it? But if it's not okay, there needs to be consequences for it. And so I think the American people are fed up with this. I think this is what builds more and more distrust and more of a divide. And these are the exact sort of changes that I think need to be part of our comprehensive strategy looking forward the next 2 years.
Jonathan Solomon interviewing Jessica Anderson with Executive Action. Next is an interview that Steve Hilton had with Peter Schweitzer about Mitch McConnell and his wife and their relationship with the Chinese government. Here we go now.
Welcome back. We're joined now by a good friend, author of Profiles in Corruption, president of the Government Accountability Institute, and indefatigable swamp investigator, Peter Schweitzer. Peter, I've been saying that Mitch McConnell represents everything that's wrong and broken with politics and government. You've really looked into this. Tell us more.
Yeah, I mean, really, it goes to the fact that Mitch McConnell and Elaine Chao, his wife, are financially tied to the Chinese government. And it comes through the shipbuilding company that Elaine Chao's family owns. That relationship was forged in December of 1993 when James Chao, Elaine Chao's father, Elaine Chao, and the new son-in-law, Senator Mitch McConnell, visited Beijing, China at the invitation of the China State Shipbuilding Corporation. This was a coup to Beijing because Tiananmen Square had happened just 4 years earlier. Very few high officials went there. The result of that meeting and the deals that followed is that today the Chinese government finances the construction of the ships for the shipbuilding company. They build the ships. They provide the crews for the ship, and they provide the cargo for the ship. So the Chinese government could pull the plug tomorrow on this business. And the reason they're doing business with them, let's make it clear, is because Mitch McConnell is a very powerful figure in Washington, D.C. And the problem is, Steve, that his position on China has softened over the years the closer that this commercial relationship has become. And he's a direct beneficiary of what this business does.
And the thing that's so interesting as you're talking is, it's just uncanny, isn't it? We're hearing all this sort of chatter, excited chatter in the establishment media about, well, you know, Joe Biden, he's going to get along well with Mitch McConnell and they're going to be able to do it. No wonder they're going to get along well. They're both up to their necks in Chinese corruption.
Yeah, that's right. And this is by Chinese design, by the way. This is their strategy. They've done it in Australia, in New Zealand, in Singapore. They seek out political elites and they give them commercial deals. What I would say is that in the Biden case, there is no legitimate business. I mean, the Bidens bring nothing to the table, no expertise, no background. At least in the McConnell-Chao case, you could argue there's actually a shipbuilding company to begin with. But you're absolutely right. They are wedded to the Chinese. They don't want to anger the Chinese because it could destroy their families financially.
And then the last point I'd make is that it's often said about Mitch McConnell that the only thing he really cares about is protecting money in politics, because that's what gives him real power. What do you make of that?
Yeah, no, I think it's true. I mean, there are a lot of requirements on members of Congress and the House to raise a lot of money. There's a lot of money going into super PACs. I believe in you know, freedom of speech and that individuals have a right to do it. But there's no question that a lot of the fundraising that takes place in Washington, D.C. is a sort of extortion model. You've got to pony up money to the leadership in the House and in the Senate. If you don't, you don't get a seat at the table. So a lot of companies give out of compulsion, not because they're necessarily enthusiastic, and Mitch McConnell is part of that system, no question about it.
Yeah, exactly. Honestly, I mean, it's all got to change, and I hope it can be the Republican Party that fights for that change. Peter, great to see you this evening. Really appreciate it. Thanks.
Great to see you, Steve. Thanks.
Closing out is Liz Kennedy interviewing KT McFarland about what's really going on in Washington.
Okay, back with me now is KT McFarland, former Trump Deputy National Security Advisor. KT, we love having you on. Okay, big fight between top Democrat Adam Schiff. Adam Schiff is criticizing former acting DNI Rick Grenell of being too political. But Rick Grenell is saying, wait a second, you're the House Intelligence Chair. You regularly leaked and distorted classified information to go after President Trump and his administration. Your thoughts on this fight?
You know, normally, Liz, I don't like to get in the middle of these spats. I usually kind of avoid them. But in this case, Rick Grenell has Adam Schiff dead. He just has him dead in the water. And here's why. You know, Adam Schiff is chairman of the Judiciary Committee, House Judiciary Committee. He, for 3 years, he got hearings behind closed doors, classified hearings, where they said time and again, there's nothing to the Russia collusion story. There was no collusion. President Trump had nothing to do with the Russians. There was never anything to the Mike Flynn thing. They, day after day after day, he got these briefings. But you know what he then did? He would run out to the press and he would say openly, baldly, you know, he would say, look, I've just had an important intelligence briefing and I think Donald Trump has colluded with Putin. I think he's Putin's puppet, I think were his words. So not only was he leaking, he was lying about it. So I think Rick Grenell has a real point here. Adam Schiff, you know, I'm not really sure what he was trying to do other than to promote Russia, Russia, Russia is the main problem. And the real problem is that because of that, because of the Russia, Russia, Russia obsession, we took our eye off the ball. The real problem was China, China, China.
You know, KT, the litmus test might be if leaks continue out of House Intelligence under the Biden administration. You know, somebody, a critic said, an intelligence source said, you know, it's pretty rich, somebody who politicized intelligence for so many years, like Adam Schiff did, is accusing others of politicizing. So that's the fight there. And, you know, Rick Grenell is saying, listen, I asked for reforms out of Adam Schiff to help us with reforms, and he didn't do it. These are reforms that career intelligence officials, Rick Grenell said, wanted. But Schiff blocked that. Your thoughts on that?
You know, if anybody's ever reading an article or they're hearing a report, the minute you hear anonymous sources in the intelligence community, turn it off. Stop reading. Anonymous sources in the Intelligence Committee just means somebody's putting out a story, spinning it, and trying to accomplish something that they were not normally able to accomplish in the normal course of events. And here's how it happens. Let's say you're in the intelligence community and you want to investigate somebody. Let's say you want to investigate Donald Trump. Well, you leak the story, and it's illegal to do it. So what you do, you leak stories in the press, and then you can point, you, the intelligence official, you can point to the story in the press and say, see, I think that's a just cause. We've got to go investigate this. So they're reporting, they're leaking, and then they're turning to the story they leaked in the first place to do stuff they're probably not supposed to do.
Yeah. I mean, that's what happened with the FBI using the Yahoo News story by Michael Isikoff that was a leak in order to get a FISA wiretap on, I think, Carter Page. You know, so here the thing is that the leaks got so bad that DNI Ratcliffe had to cancel in-person briefings. The FBI was actually, declassified doc show, the FBI was actually helping Adam Schiff read documents. And then he goes on and leaked and distorted. That's the accusation. And then Adam Schiff also sat on 5 dozen transcripts that Devin Nunes worked on with the House Intelligence Probe into Trump Russia, you know, showing there was no there. And Schiff sat on it. So you wonder in the Biden administration what it's going to look like with Adam Schiff. Your final word.
Well, let's see. You know, is Adam Schiff going to continue to shill for the Democrats? If so, then I think the leaks are all going to make the Biden administration sound terrific. However, Adam Schiff may decide, he's just going to shill for himself. Who knows? We'll have to stay tuned, Liz. It should be a lot of fun to watch.
Okay, stay tuned. KT McFarland, thank you for joining us. It's good to see you.
Thanks,
Come back.